cazzo sto terento. E ci è chi può di nazarina mu ferri a rotulo. E ci è chi può di nazarina mu ferri a rotulo. Don 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 c'è canonico e non do. Na pai na prede che si nasca scesi don purpito. Na pai na prede che si nasca scesi don purpito.
Hello and welcome to Arts Express here on CITR. I'm Katie Fitzpatrick. I'm your host today. So we have an interesting show today. We have a new author here to talk to us about his book, and we're going to be interviewing him shortly. And we're also going to be having a review of the new movie Persepolis. And we're also going to have some listings, and we're finally going to have a review of the new play that's on right now, which is called 3 Days of Rain Review. And we're actually going to go to that one right now. That's from arts volunteer Megan Turcato, and so it's about the new play on right now, 3 Days of Rain Review. When I come back, we'll have some listings, and then we'll be talking to the author shortly.
This weekend, I took in 3 Days of Rain, a play with two very distinct acts, as they are separated by 3 decades and employ a different cast of characters. First, we meet Walker and his sister Nan, who, along with Pip, the son of their father's business partner, have gathered a year after their father's funeral to hear his will. When 3 Days Rain opens, one gets a sense that the story is picking up a year after the end of a sequel, and that all the action in the story has long since taken place. But suddenly, the years of covert silence and secrecy are ripped open as the characters no longer hold back any secrets, their own or those of their parents. When Walker finds his father's journal, lives, loves, and losses are examined in a whole new light. The second act goes back to the 1960s, when their parents were young adults, and shows the audience that the ways the children have explained, justified, and rendered neat and orderly their parents' lives was not necessarily what happened. Here the play grasps at poignancy, yet despite 2 hours of aggressive character development and the dramatic technique of revealing the character's legacy and the reflection of their lives before ever hearing from the characters themselves, the play lacked deep insight. Maybe I'm looking too hard for a meaning deeper than simply that lives are often misconstrued, even by those closest to them. Watching the play, I felt as if it was all leading up to some large cosmic point, but in the end, I felt as though I had taken a long journey, always imagining the end would be an exciting destination, but instead I was shoved off the train in the middle of nowhere. Perhaps, as they say, the point is not the destination, but the journey. Judged with this criteria, 3 Days Rain is a success. It's a smart play, which carefully examines the subtlety of human relationships, finding its humor as much in what is left unsaid by the characters as what comes out in the many explosive monologues. There are only 3 actors in 3 Days of Rain. They each portray both the child and the parent at the same age. Richard Stroth did a particularly good job transforming from the unstable and overindulged Walker to the painfully shy Ned. Jade Shaw and Elliot Mandelkorn also shone in this challenging play, rife with volatile emotions and long monologues. However, I felt the cast embraced their second roles more fully than those in the first act. This seemed somehow appropriate as the children, Nan, Pip, and Walker, existed primarily as a reflection of their parents' lives. 3 Days of Rain is playing at the Beaumont Theater, located at 316 West 5th Ave, till January 19th. For you students out there on a small budget, I'd like to mention there is a Pay What You Can matinee Saturday, January 19th at 2 p.m. The Beaumont Studios itself is easy to miss on an out-of-the-way street. Inside, however, they have created a comfortable and intimate space in which to foster quality local theater and visual arts. So I'd encourage anyone so inclined to go check it out.
All right, so that was Megan Turcotto with her review of 3 Days of Rain. And if you're interested in theater, there's lots of other events you can check out this week. One of them is The Black Rider, the casting of The Magic Bullets, and that's on right now at the Granville Island stage with the Arts Club. It's a part of the Push Festival, and it's presented by November Theater and the Arts Club. And it's an expressionist musical created by Tom Waits, William S. Burroughs, and Robert Wilson. That's till February 9th, and I'm actually going to be checking that one out tomorrow night, and I'm going to have a review next week, as well as an interview with the lead actor and artistic director of November Theater, whose name is Michael Scholar Jr. Another play currently on as part of the Push Festival is Frankenstein. Catalyst Theatre presents an adaptation of Mary Shelley's classic Gothic novel. You can find more information about that at www.pushfestival.ca, showing till January 26th at the Vancouver East Cultural Centre at 1895 at Venables. Another show currently on at the Havana is one that looks pretty interesting for myself as I work at a restaurant as well. It's called Dish Pig. Greg Landucci plays 15 roles in TJ Dawes' behind-the-scenes look at the life of a restaurant dishwasher. That's till January 19th, once again, at the Havana. One woman show currently on at the Vancouver Playhouse is The Blonde, the Brunette, and the Vengeful Redhead. Lucy Peacock portrays 7 different characters in a one-woman production about the shattered life of a suburban housewife. That's till February 2nd. Finally, there's some also events going on in literary events. One is Street Stories, a presentation of Michael Barnholden and Nancy Newman's collaborative work about 100 years of homelessness in Vancouver. That's also featuring photos, interviews, and essays. It's free admission. It's on January 17th from 7 to 8:30 p.m., and it's at the Burnaby Public Library at the Metrotown branch. Another literary event going on shortly is A Spoonful of Stories. The Vancouver Society of Storytellers presents an evening of stories by Helen May, Mary Gavin, Brian Nelson, Wing Su Wong, and Pauline Wen, plus an open mic. That's January 20th from 7:30 to 9:30 at Trinity St. Mark's Church at 1805 Larch. Admission is $5. And also you'll want to keep in mind that coming up in February is the Story Feast Storytelling Festival, and we're also going to have an interview from some storytellers and one of the organizers of that group coming up, I believe, on January 29th. Now, in a minute, we're going to be coming back with Tariq Malik, and we're going to be talking to him about his new book, Rain Songs of Kotli. But first, we're going to go to these messages, and then we'll be right back.
Let me get this straight.
Experimental days of broadcasting as such are over.
Thursday, January 17th, CITR celebrates Art's birthday with another 24 hours of radio art.
To confuse.
The Art of Sounds, Thursday, January 17th, midnight to midnight, 24 hours of radio art. Happy birthday, Art, from CITR 101.9, Vancouver, for CITR.ca.
Well, of course, that's the sound you don't hear very often. But it is the real thing.
You must keep reminding yourself. It's just a
sound collage.
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 Only a madman could understand it all.
I can understand that.
All right, so that's the 24 hours of radio art coming up on Thursday, which you're going to want to keep your ears open for, I suppose. And right now, as I said, we're back with Tariq Malik. So first of all, do you want to just introduce yourself to us a little bit?
Well, I've been writing for quite a time, but my first book came out in 2004, and it was introduced to the public in about 2005. And since then, I've moved on to other books. I'm working on another project. And the book has acquired a life all its own because it comes from a small publisher, mm-hmm. and it has been chugging along by itself.
And is that a local Vancouver publisher, I guess?
No, this is this was published actually by Vasanji, M.G. Vasanji's publishing house, Saad Publications, out of Toronto.
Oh, okay. Interesting. Yep. Now, you've lived in Pakistan, Kuwait, and Canada, and I assume you've visited other places as well. So I'm wondering, what has it been like, your experience as an immigrant in Kuwait and in Canada?
It's been an extremely interesting experience in the sense that you never really are centered at any time. I lived 20 years in Kuwait, and before that, another 20, I would say, in Pakistan. And then I've been in Canada for about 15 years. So it's been quite challenging, but it always allows you to stand outside your skin and look at yourself as if you were a third person. So you're always dislocated. There's this element of loss, of homesickness, mm-hmm. and dislocation, which I think pervades this book.
Mm-hmm.
Essentially, since the first story begins as homesickness and other fevers,
mm-hmm.
and that addresses this sense of dislocation.
Right. Now, I'm also wondering, this, you sort of just mentioned this already, but how have having multiple nationalities, how has that shaped you as a writer?
Oh, it adds to your bank of experiences, because you're exposed to different cultures, different people, different experiences, and you get to draw from all of these sources
mm-hmm.
and adapt all these skins that you're in.
And your book is sort of multicultural in a way, I guess. It has a lot of other languages in it. I assume it's mostly Punjabi.
It's mostly Punjabi, but there's a little bit of Arabic because there's a section on Kuwait in there.
Right, yeah.
And, of course, since it's in English, but most of the dialogue had to be, I had to mentally translate, mm-hmm. consciously translate from Punjabi and Arabic into English.
Oh, okay.
And that's quite a challenge.
And why did you choose to leave a lot of the stuff in Punjabi?
Well, there's only so much you can translate. Punjabi doesn't translate very well into English.
Mm.
And there's always the challenge of how much are you going to adopt or mm-hmm. drop off from the culture. But the book, I didn't want the book to be too colorful, but it still had to translate mm-hmm. its essence.
Right.
So the cultural essence only comes across if you retain some of the true words that have been used
mm-hmm.
to describe the experience.
Now, in, is it Shafiq, the sacrificial
Shafiq,
circuit?
Yes.
And also in Mita Dabawa, I don't know if I'm saying these words right, but
okay.
In those two stories, we see technology and it's changing people's lives and it's taking away their jobs. The character in Mita Dabawa loses his printing job and stuff because of the new factories and everything like that. So how do you think that technology is affecting the area that you're writing about? Is it all positive or all negative?
I think it is mostly negative. It's been really drastic for a town like Kotli, which is basically craftsmen.
Mm-hmm.
It's a home of craftsmen, very, very skillful craftsmen who have been there for about 600 years. And they've been plying their trade for 600 years very successfully, in mm-hmm. direct contrast to all the villages around them. And the minute we hit the age of industrialization, there's no need for this handmade artifacts. It's just everything can be manufactured. So there's no need for this quality finish to things.
Right.
And it proves very drastic to this. And that's what I've written, that within a single generation, more than half of the village inhabitants move away from the village. And that saps the energy from the village. And
mm-hmm.
that's, now it's a generic town. There's nothing to distinguish it from countless other towns.
Mm-hmm.
But as long as they had their cultural history, they were alive, vibrant, they were the envy of people thousands of miles around them.
Now, do you think that they could have just excluded that technology and stayed the same, or do you think with the way the world was moving, they really had no choice but to...
I think they had been excluded from the world anyway. I mean, they were living in the amidst the most fertile land on earth.
Mm-hmm.
Punjab was known to grow two crops a year,
almost
1,000 years ago.
Wow.
And that's how rich it was. And yet, they were not farmers. They turned their back on the land, and they focused all their energy on their craftsmanship, which was metalworking.
Okay, right. That makes sense. So now without that, it's hard to turn back to the agriculture and anything like that at this point, right? Now, in this book also, we see many sides of religion. So there's Sikhism, and then there's predominantly Islam in it. And I'm a religious studies major myself, study world religion, so I found that really interesting. And we see it as inspirational to people. It's also just kind of daily routine. And then there's the jinns that are kind of cultural superstition kind of that come in there. And then, you know, there's also kind of the violence when we deal with the partition between the religious groups and stuff like that. So how do you see religion as its role in our modern kind of age?
You have to remember that Pakistan was formed totally based on one religion, a single religion.
Mm-hmm.
It was the Muslims who wanted to separate from India because
right.
they could not see themselves playing a role under the dominance of the Hindus.
Right.
And their dissatisfaction with the way they were dealt led to Pakistan being formed.
Mm-hmm.
And since then, you can see what states which are built on religion itself, where the side effects of that decision. We are still seeing that. Look
mm-hmm.
at all the violence that the world has fallen into.
Mm-hmm.
And partially it arises from decisions like these. You have to remember that Palestine, for instance, was divided in 1948. And then you have 48. And then Pakistan came into being in 47 out of India. But these are all partially religious solutions.
Mm-hmm. So it's really affecting political national
situations. Yes, because you cannot draw religious lines. You cannot divide people mm-hmm. along religious. It does not work.
I mean, even the United States, I don't think there's any candidate that isn't, you know, seen in church praying and things like that. It isn't part of their sort of political stance. It's
exactly.
Yeah, it's pretty difficult to separate those, I suppose. Now, I suspect that the Shafiq, the sacrificial circuit, is a true story. So do you want to tell me a bit about that?
Shafiq was my cousin, twice removed, and he was sort of a big brother figure. I looked up to him a lot because he was about 10 years older than I was. And I was very young at the time that he passed away. And his whole life became as a model for me to mm-hmm. look up to. But his passing away was really tragic. It devastated our families. It still continues to haunt us for what we remember of this brilliant, wasted person. But he, mm-hmm. in a way, is a nutshell of the experiences that people from Kotli have had in the Middle East. Or South Asians generally still continue to do in the Gulf states. There are about 4 to 5 million workers from India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, and Sri Lanka. And their lives have not changed in the last 60 years.
And why is it that so many of them are moving to the area to find new types of jobs?
It's the failure of their own home countries to gainfully employ them. Mm-hmm. And since they're not able to make a living, they tend to take these risks to go out and venture into different countries.
And how did you find your experience in Kuwait when you were living there?
For me, it's been a very difficult experience, especially Kuwait, because I was very young when I went there. Mm-hmm. And having to eke out a living out mm-hmm. of very hostile conditions. Mm. Being a non-Kuwaiti, you're made aware of your standing generally.
Right.
And it still exists. It hasn't changed all these years. My book is set in 1957, 47 mm-hmm. to 57. And yet, from the time of Shafiq in 1957 to 2007, nothing much has changed. Mm. People are still being exploited.
Now, one thing that I noticed in your novel is that most of the stories, you don't tell them in a really direct way, and all the plots sort of interweave and overlap. And why did you choose to write it in that style?
Well, one of the reasons was I didn't want to use any formulas, accepted formulas for the book. I also wanted to layer the book into various experiences so that you're immersed in different people's experiences. And, of course, they interweave with dreams, with subjective experiences, and how a character perceives a certain situation. So I did the same with the plot lines also, that they're not radial. You don't see from A, you don't go from A to B. Mm-hmm. There are several detours on the way so that you tend to see the story as a weave of different experiences.
Yeah, I think I noticed that, especially in The Stalker, The Peacock House as well. He kind of goes forward to finding the marble, and then he goes back to telling the story of why and things like that.
So. I'm glad you picked up on that.
Oh, good. Now, also, you know, how do you feel about the Canadian literary scene? Like, where do you think it's going?
I think it's very vibrant. We are generating the most dynamic and lively literature right now. Mm-hmm. Vibrant literature that's coming out of Canada.
I also feel the same way. And yeah, and obviously it's interesting. We have so many different nationalities also contributing. It makes for a very, I guess, exciting sort of literary scene as well. Now, finally, I'm going to ask if you have any upcoming projects coming up.
I'm working on a book about the Komagata Maru.
Oh, great. That's interesting.
Komagata Maru incident, which was set in 1914, just mm-hmm. pre-war, before the First World War started. And I've completed the first draft of the book, and I'm looking for an agent or a publisher.
All right.
So wish me luck once I have the right contacts.
Well, publishers out there.
Once I have the right contacts, I'm going to publish that.
And do you want to tell people a little bit about what that incident was? Because I'm familiar with it. It's interesting.
This was in... it happened on 23rd May 1914 mm-hmm. that 376 South Asians meaning from India, mm-hmm. British India, who were British citizens, came to Vancouver in the hope of settling down here. Their claim to landing here was that the king had given them permission or the right to move anywhere within the British Empire. And yet, in British Columbia, there were orders in council which contradicted that. Mm. And due to that, they were trapped here for 60 days, in which they fought. They made their claim in the Supreme Court and were unsuccessful. Eventually, they were forced to leave. And that led to further tragedies.
And sail all the way back?
Yeah, the problem was they violated the laws which were in place for exiting a country and for entering the country. So they'd done both, and they'd already, it had become a hot button, because this is where the partition of India begins.
Mm.
It's actually the Ghadar movement, the rebellion movement, the second rebellion movement to get the British out of India begins.
Oh, that's interesting.
And Vancouver plays a very important part in that.
That's interesting as well, because we also have this whole idea of, oh, we're always so multicultural and tolerant. And it's then when you see the history of certain incidents, it's not, it's a little more fuzzy sometimes, yes, as far as those issues are concerned. And I didn't realize there was a link there between that and the partition. So that would be, I will definitely look for that book when it does come out and try to read it. So thanks very much for talking with us today. Once again, his book is called Rain Songs of Cotley. I really recommend it. And do you know where they can find it? Anywhere in particular?
Or any bookstore.
Any bookstore. Okay. There you go. Thanks very much.
And
once again, we'll be back with Arts Express with another review and some more listings after this announcement.
We're here to inform you about African Awareness Week happening at UBC between the dates of February 1st and February 8th.
This is a unique event with the purpose of increasing awareness about the importance of Africa studies at UBC. We will accomplish this by holding seminars, workshops, and events during that week and presenting world-class African scholars, writers, artists, and activists to carry our mission of exceeding the layperson's expectations of how much Africa has to give to the world.
All are welcomed. For more information or for details on the seminars, workshops, and events, please visit the website at www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca. If you want to know the truth and drop a stereotypical perception of Africa, this is your chance to become an informed citizen. www.africa-awareness.ubc.ca.
All right, so you're back listening to Arts Express. That was Africa Awareness Week that we were talking about. It's just coming out February 1st to 8th, and I'm sure there's lots of events going on campus for that, so you're going to want to keep your eyes open. Once again, you're listening to CITR 101.9, and I'm your host, Katie Fitzpatrick. Now, soon we're going to be getting to a review of a movie called Persepolis, which is reviewed by frequent arts volunteer Tracy Fuller. You've probably heard her before if you're a frequent listener. But before we get to that, we're going to talk about a few more listings. So first of all, in music, there's String of Pearls. New York-based violinist Maureen Yoon and pianist Carrie Lee Morlang play works by Schubert, Mozart, Saint-Saëns, Stravinsky, and Beethoven. That's at the Silk Purse Arts Center in West Vancouver. Also coming up is Michael Murray. The organist plays works by Buxtehude, Willian, Vivaldi, Bach, Part, and Glass. And please excuse me if I pronounce any of those wrong. That is January 16th, which is tomorrow, I think, at the UBC Recital Hall here on campus. Also coming up is the Mozart Cycle. James Enns performs Mozart's violin concertos. That's January 18th to 19th at 8 p.m. at the Chan Center for the Performing Arts, also here on campus. And if we have time at the end of the show today, we're going to be playing a little bit of Mozart. So if you're going to go see that on the 18th, we'll get you all warmed up for that. Another event coming up in music is Spotlight, the VSO at the Roundhouse. Pianist-conductor Bramwell Tovey performs the North American premiere of his own Pictures in the Smoke, plus work by Omar Daniel, Brian Tierney, and Harold Meltzer. That is January 18th at 8 p.m. at the Roundhouse Community Arts and Recreation Center, which actually often has some really good events on, so it's a good venue to keep your eyes open for. Also in music, there's the... Sorry, one second. There's the Cecilia Ensemble's Women's Choir. Lars Cario conducts a performance of Pergliosi's Stabat Mater, featuring guest soprano Catherine Crouch and organist Dennis Bedard. That's a benefit for the Covenant House Vancouver, which assists homeless youth. That's January 18th at 8 p.m. by donation at the Holy Rosary Cathedral. Finally, a couple of dance events going on. One is The Whole Beast. Solo dance work by Battery Opera's Li Su Fei explores a life shaped by food, love, and loss. That is at the SFU Theater up at their campus on January 17th at 12:30 p.m. Another dance performance going on shortly is Breakfast Dances. Link Dance Foundation presents choreography by Gail Lotenberg, performed by dancers from Vancouver and Whitehorse. That's January 20th at 10:30 a.m. at the Centennial Theatre in Lonsdale, North Vancouver. Now, a lot of events going on right now are linked to the Push Festival, so if you want to go to www.pushfestival.ca, you can find out about all those events. There's lots of great ones, all performing arts centered, some of them quite creative. I know one of their performances having children give people haircuts spontaneously however they feel like it. That's a performance they're putting on, so might be something you want to check out. Now, we'll be back shortly, and soon we're going to check out the review of Persepolis by arts volunteer Tracy Fuller.
The film adaptation of Marjan Satrapi's graphic novel series Persepolis is nothing short of a masterpiece. Not only does Satrapi's film maintain the unique artistic style that characterizes her books, which looks a bit like Art Deco meets Spiegelman's Mouse in Iran, but the movie version brings her illustrations to life. Marjan's coming-of-age memoir is both touching and hilarious while maintaining the edge of an intelligent internal exposé. Her story does not skimp or shy away from the terrifying and repressive realities that shape Marjan's young life. Satrapi chronicles the rise of the Islamic Revolution, giving audiences the inside story from an artfully nuanced female perspective. Air raid sirens, senseless deaths, arrested uncles, and unanswered questions are the daily realities that surround Marjan as she matures in Iran. Her bold precociousness causes her no end of trouble, which prompts her wise yet frightened parents to send her to Austria so that she can mature in relative peace. What Marjan sees in Vienna, however, is a surreal parallel universe that either ignores the war in Iran or condemns it absolutely, without knowledge, question, or reservation. Unsurprisingly, the Iranian government does not approve of Satrapi's frank yet funny film and have protested the film's inclusion at international film festivals in Toronto, New York, and abroad. In Bangkok, Iranian pressure did successfully stop the film's screening. Nevertheless, Persepolis's inclusion in the Cannes Film Festival in France garnered Satrapi the coveted jury prize in 2007. Under the pretense that no publicity is bad publicity, Iran's disapproval may have helped the small movie gain the notoriety it needed to be selected as France's official foreign language entry for the 2008 Academy Awards. A little controversy is almost de rigueur when it comes to French films, is it not? Marjan's journey is peppered with famous supporting cast members, including God, Marx, and Godzilla, who looks better as a cartoon than he ever did as a live-action monster. The film is accompanied by a soundtrack that includes 80s rock heroes like Survivor, Iron Maiden, and of course the international 80s pariah, Michael Jackson. I always know a film is good when I hear the movie-going audience laugh unabashedly during the funny bits and sniffle during the silences. According to the Tinseltown Theatre staff, every screening of Persepolis this weekend was practically sold out. And since the Pender Street Theatre is the only place in town showing Persepolis, I would definitely arrive early if I were planning to catch the film this week. Mature cartoons like Persepolis and The Triplets of Belleville have been gaining momentum and screen time over the past decade. As these films draw larger crowds, hopefully we will see many more thought-provoking and tear-inducing features in the very near future. In my opinion, Canadian graphic artists like Seth and Chester Brown need to jump on this bandwagon while the going is good. Louis Riel is dying for a film. As I said, Marjan Satrapi's film Persepolis is an early 2008 must-see. Get out to the Tinseltown theaters and see it this week. It's worth every second and every penny. For The Arts Show, I'm Tracy Fuller.
All right, so a very good review for Persepolis from Tracy Fuller, and usually she does a bit of pro and a bit of con, and this one it was almost all pro, so it's probably something that's really worth checking out. And if you're interested in movies this week, there's some interesting ones going on at Fifth Avenue Cinemas. One is No Country for Old Men. It's been out for a while. Another is The Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which I reviewed last week, which was very interesting. Another one was The Savages. Juno was still showing, which I actually reviewed a couple weeks ago as well. And the new one out with Daniel Day-Lewis that's getting a lot of buzz is There Will Be Blood. So that's one you probably want to check out as well. And once again, you're going to want to tune in next week to Arts Express. We're going to be talking to Michael Scholar Jr. from The Black Rider, and I'm going to be reviewing his play, which is part of the Push Festival. And we're also going to have a review of an art gallery and a film as well. We're getting some of those ideas in the works. So I'm going to leave you with a little bit of Mozart in case you want to get warmed up for the upcoming Mozart concerts. And then we're going to go to Reel with a movie critic. I can't remember his name. But anyway, we're going to get to him, and he's going to be giving you some movie reviews on Reel.